Welcome to Season 3 of the Chai Break Podcast. We're excited to engage in more inspiring chaivisations around our cross-cultural experiences.
This season, we're diving deep into an often gray area and a taboo in our culture, mental health and well-being. So, join us on our mission to break the barriers and get comfortable in those often uncomfortable spaces. Hello, hello. Welcome back to the Chai Break Podcast, where we're talking about all the various facets of mental health in the South Asian space this season. Hi, Rama. How are you doing today? And who do we have on the podcast?
Hi, Shweta. I'm doing great. I just got back from Trinidad. Was at the Trinidad Carnival.
Oh,
it was wonderful. And then we went off to another island in the Grenadines, which was just a slice from paradise. And I am back all tanned with a load of vitamin D. And yes, so yeah. Anyway, speaking of today's episode, it just dawned upon me that this season we've had chaivisations about our personal experiences. The whole season is dedicated to mental health in the South Asian space. We've heard from professional therapists and psychologists. But today's guest is the first of her kind on this podcast. She is the author of two books, both on mental health, especially South Asian mental health. So this is very exciting for us. So meet Mrinal Gokhale. Mrinal is an Indian-American writer. She began her career as a freelance journalist in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And as part of her work, she reported on Mental Health Awareness Month events for Hispanic and African Asian American publications. And she realized that these conversations were kind of lacking in the Asian and South Asian space. With an aim to increase education and acceptance of mental health among South Asian generations, while also showing non-South Asians how intersectionality looks in this diaspora, she went on to author two books, both anthologies, the first one in 2021 called Saya Unveiled and Taboo, South Asian Mental Health Stories, just published in 2023. So this is amazing and this is so perfect for what we want to accomplish in this podcast. So welcome to the Chai Break Podcast, Mrinal. We're so intrigued by your books and can't wait to dive into this process and hear your experience and lots more. So welcome.
Hello, thank you for having me.
We're excited to have you here. Yeah.
So before we get into the final details about your journey as an author, what was it like growing up being part of an immigrant family in the Midwest and also just the whole process of navigating your dual identity as you grew up here?
So I grew up in a suburb of Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Milwaukee is either number one or number two on the most segregated cities in the United States, right behind Detroit, I think. And I was actually born in Michigan in a Detroit suburb and then moved to Wisconsin when I was a four-year-old and have stepped around since. And I would say that growing up, I could count the number of fellow Desi children that went to my school on one hand. And I went to a K through 6 and 7 through 12 school, so that's saying a lot. And however, I will say that my family did belong to things like they met other Indian people in like the temples and like this thing called Maharashtra Mandir that we went to because, you know, I'm Marathi. And they had like circles that they associated with then when we were a lot younger. And I think that how that was it was interesting in that, like so many other Desi immigrants' children, the culture inside the home was Desi, but was American as it could get outside, like in the school systems. So, and one thing that my therapist taught me was that it's very developmentally normal to have this attitude of, I just want to be American when you're young. And then early adulthood onwards, like, okay, I want my native culture and my ancestry back. It's totally possible to have both. And in a nutshell, that is how I experienced it.
That is wonderful because I've grown up kids and they're still in their teens. Shweta has a little daughter. So when you're saying these things, and so in my head, I'm just going with the parenting thing because we both were born in India and we moved like, you know, quite a few years ago. I moved here more than 20 years ago. And, you know, we've had this conflicts of identity. I mean, we've been really ingrained in the Indian culture, is so ingrained in us. But here we come to America and it's like, you know, we're seeing all these, the other side, the Western side of approach to life. And, you know, we're here trying to pick and choose which will suit us. suit our identity that we want to cultivate. So our kids are probably having the same issues as you say. And, you know, I tried to force my daughter to learn Bharatanatyam, and she doesn't want to do it. And I'm pretty sure she's going to come back to me in like 5-10 years from now and say, why did you not force me to do this? Because I want to learn about my culture.
Yeah.
So I just don't know. This is quite a complex issue. Yeah.
You know, my question would be, you know, obviously I'll never have the answer, but what if I had grown up somewhere such as New York or Florida or California, where, you know, there is more Indian people living there. So I won't say that there's none in Wisconsin or in the Milwaukee area. There's definitely more than, you know, like a rural area would have, but it's still nothing compared to those big areas, like I mentioned. So it's like, what if, you know, I couldn't count the number of Indian kids on one hand in my school system, then I'd be surrounded by lots of people that had the same struggles as I did when it came to being a Desi immigrant's child. And, you know, what if then would it, things have been different and I would have had the ability or desire to integrate both cultures at an earlier age?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. You never know. That's so true. And in our conversations earlier offline, you were mentioning about your own journey dealing with the model minority myth. Can you talk to us about that?
Sure. So my definition, if someone asked me what the model minority myth was, is the ideology that certain groups of people are unequivocally and effortlessly successful. So in this context, what that could mean is how, you know, you turn on the television or maybe even in real life, you'll see that a lot of Indian people, you know, have a set of parents that want them to either be a doctor, lawyer, engineer in a STEM field. And you see that a lot of, maybe IT departments are run by Indian or South Asian people. You'll see that a lot of doctors you see happen to be brown. And I think that it's seen as a positive stereotype in a sense, in that, you know, it's not bad to be successful. It's not bad to be smart. But I think that, you know, growing up internalizing that message is harmful because it creates unnecessary pressures. And then, as you'll see in my book, stigma around mental health.
Yeah. And I think so for you, you know, you chose an unconventional career path, right? You did not go through the STEM field, et cetera. So how was that? Like, was it acceptable at home? Did you have to, like, you know, fight a lot of battles? Like, how was that like?
I fought my battles when I was a small child. I think that my parents would even tell you, you know, one thing that differed about me compared to any other kid that they knew when I was little was, A, I became argumentative at the age of 4 or 5. I think they would tell you that whenever I was asked to do something, I had to understand the logic behind it. And I would be labeled defiant for asking that a lot and argumentative. And I think that I'll say too that, you know, both my parents were had engineering degrees. So in a way, I kind of grew up in entitlement, if you want to call it that. And it was very difficult for them to explain to me why it's important to excel in school and much less get straight A's, which is an ideology I don't agree with to this day. And I would push back up with them hard starting at a young age. And I remember having arguments like clockwork with my father starting at the age of 9 regarding both them wanting me to get straight A's as well as being like a math and science whiz, which happened to me be my worst subjects, which happened to be their best subjects. So in their brain, there was no excuse for why I couldn't excel in it. And they actually would take turns working with me one-on-one for each subject every year so that I would do okay in it. And it's like, you know, with their help, I did it. I would get a low A maybe, but I still didn't like it. And I think that by the time high school rolled around and we were talking about what I would study and whatnot, I was very loud and clear that I wanted to be a writer. And so then there was a bit of a compromise involved where they said, well, why not pair it with something a little bit more practical, so to speak? And so that's why I got a degree in marketing and a minor in journalism.
So reflecting back on that situation, what do you think? Did that have an effect on how you look at life now, how you've kind of grown as a person now, your mental health now, that kind of pressure?
In the sense that my story is unique, but at the same time, not.
Yeah.
I think that so many, I'm sure many people that you interviewed or will interview will report similar encounters and having to fight similar battles and whatnot. And I think that at least times are changing now, slowly but surely. And I think that I will never endorse academic pressure and promoting the ideology of making a child uphold the model minority myth stereotype ever. Mm-hmm. But I think that looking back at the younger me, I would tell younger me that academics are important and that she'll understand when she gets older.
Yeah. That is so true, because I relate to your story so much, because I actually went to engineering school against my wish and then quit 2 years later, you know, when the whole recession happened in 2008. And what I always wanted to do was actually write, because I was always good at like poetry, creative writing, elocution, debates. That was my thing in school. But again, you know, that was never considered even a career choice. So I so relate to that.
And let me say too that writing my book, Your Story, happened a lot, where people will go with the status quo, study something such as engineering or medicine, you know, and change over to something else after the first 2 years or something, or sit in a therapist's office after they graduate, like, I do not want to do this. And I said this to my mother and I told her about it. And then I even said, you know, I didn't have to do that because I was clear from day one that I didn't want to do it. And she was like, of course you didn't, and this and that. I was like, I should be getting props.
I can totally see that.
That's true. And cut to today, you're a successful author of 2 books around South Asian mental health. What has your own journey with mental health been like, and how have you navigated that?
I would say it's an intense one, just as much as so many of the stories you'll read in my book, but also unique in other ways. So my journey started, I will say that it started when I was a little girl, such as with the stories I just told you. And I'll just say in a nutshell, growing up, I had lots of social as well as academic challenges that weren't addressed. And I think that looking back, that had to do with gender, and it had to do with race. It had to do with the fact that I was a shy, quiet kid that would disrupt the class type thing. So first of all, with the social aspect, I was painfully shy. And also, we would observe early that when mommy and daddy would set up a play date with someone, they would come over and then they wouldn't come over again. And, for the longest time, they thought that it was just a shyness problem. But I think over time, one of my parents would point out, you know, I think it runs a little deeper than that. You know, I think it's something she's doing, like, you know, maybe she keeps talking about the same thing over and over, or playing, wanting to do the same activity over and over without sensing that they're bored and want to do something else, for example. Mm-hmm. And then I think, and then growing up too, middle school and onwards, I would go through some bullying, and I didn't have a lot of friends at all. Mm-hmm. And academically, my struggles were that I had a very uneven talent profile. So I was good at things. My talents academically were memorization, spelling, reading, writing, math, memorization of facts and data and concepts. Or sorry, did I say math? No, I didn't mean that. So spelling, reading, writing, and language. And then my weaknesses were math and science. So things that were more abstract, required more nonverbal comprehension.
So you were more creative.
Yeah.
The creative end. Yeah.
So logical yet creative.
Yeah. Yeah.
So then on top of getting screamed at home for not bringing home straight A's, teachers would complain to my parents that I would constantly miss instructions, not follow directions, and turn in homework late unless my parents sat in the same room as me at home until it got done. Mm-hmm. So basically this continued, and by high school, my parents dropped their straight A expectations of me and said that a half and half is okay. Mm-hmm. And so then by the time I was in college, I'll say that I went to my student, my college's clinic for therapy with a student clinician. I got treated for severe social anxiety with exposure therapy. Mm-hmm. And at the end, I went from severe to mild to moderate range when they reevaluated me after a year and a half of work.
Okay, that's good.
And that was very helpful. And then I noticed that in the working world, after I graduated college, I would job hop a lot. I would get bored a lot. And those difficulties I told you about with things like following directions and instructions would get to me and would cause a lot of performance issues.
Yeah.
And as I said, I was job hopping a lot and struggling to figure out what the heck I wanted to do with my life. And I went back to therapy about two and a half years after I graduated college. Mm-hmm. And then a few months of meeting me, that therapist, she said to me, you know, we've been having some discussions about, you know, why you went to therapy in the past, about you being shy and this and that. Another pattern I'm picking up is that it seems like people don't know how to read you. You don't know how to read them. And I'm supposed to be the expert. And sometimes even I can't read you. Mm-hmm. And she was like, you know, most of my clients, they come in here, they're either smiling, crying, laughing, or in a rage. And with you, it's none of the above. And when I ask you questions about how the session went, you give me one-worded answers. And then she was like, you know, and you say that social anxiety is something you dealt with. And I agree with that. But you also say that things like autism runs in your family. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's something you should be tested for.
Wow. How did you react to, you know, saying that? Was it something that took you by surprise? Like, how did your family react to it?
Yeah. How were you impacted by this?
I think that she said it the right way. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I wasn't as negatively impacted by it as I thought I would be, mm-hmm. or as one would have expected. Mm-hmm. I think that she explained to me how vast the spectrum of autism really is, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. and how there's so many comorbidities that come with it diagnostically. There's different levels of how someone is affected by or struggles with it. And then she said, you know, there's going to be lots of things that you're good at, mm-hmm. even if there's lots of things that you struggle with. Mm-hmm. And I think we should focus on your strengths while also looking at other things and deciding, you know, to what degree do you want to maintain or change them, that type of thing. And then also practice advocating for yourself to explain to, you know, future friends, future boyfriends, future employers about these things.
Mm. Wow, that is such an impactful message. And I would say a more helpful message for you to really understand kind of what's going on and how best to deal with it. So how does this situation tie in with the books that you've written? You're a successful author of two books, and I have a two-part question about that, but I wanted to kind of understand whether the books followed this, you know, kind of a, you know, discovery, mm-hmm. yeah, an experience, and if so, or was it before, or how did the books kind of come in place?
Happen.
Mm-hmm. So this therapist that I saw was all the way back in 2016-ish. And then my book got published, the first one, in 2021. Mm-hmm. And how this came together is I never intended to be an author necessarily, but in quarantine, when I was locked in the house, I took a free memoir writing class virtually. And then at the end, the instructor taught us about, you know, book publishing and different avenues to take, such as self-publishing. And I was like, okay, this could be fun to do, you know, as a project. And I brainstormed topics and of interest to me, and mental health and psychology is one. And then I thought to myself, you know, I don't know a lot of Desi or South Asian people that have a mental health experience, mm-hmm. or therapy experience to share like I did. It would be interesting to investigate into that.
Yeah.
And then literally I just typed South Asian mental health into Google search bar and the hashtag on Instagram, and I got more results than I expected. Mm-hmm. And I think it's because the pandemic forced people in our community to finally talk about it.
Yeah.
And then that's when it became a trending or like a hot topic type thing that's finally getting spoken about. Mm-hmm. So then I basically just contacted like nonprofits or like doctors or healthcare orgs and said, hey, I'm doing this thing where I want to tell people stories. And they put out submission calls via their email listservs and their social media, and people would get in touch with me.
Oh, wow. And you also have, the stories that you've collected are from women across the globe, right? Mm-hmm. And it's also interesting to see that they've actually come forward to talk about it. I think that is the stigma is the biggest hurdle, you know, within the South Asian mental space. So how is that process like? And did, you know, I'm sure some of the stories were heavier than others, and, you know, it has a lot of emotion to tie to their stories. So how did all of that come about and, you know, leading up to publishing it?
So basically what I did is I put out the submission calls. People would get in touch with me. I would tell them to fill out a form with basic information regarding who they are, where they come from, their diagnosis, if any, or what basically their mental health story entails. And I would tell them that they can change their name if needed to remain anonymous. In book number one, I wanted it to be half men, half women, but I only found 2 men and 8 women, no matter how hard I looked. and asked around. So I think that says a lot about how gender-wise there might be more stigma among men too, and how they're forced to appear strong and whatnot. And I think probably that's more amplified among men of color. And so basically I would call, when these people would agree to do it, I would have verbal conversations with them virtually and just interview them, write down their stories, then write out a draft, send it back to them, have them edit it for accuracy until it all got done, then send it off for editing. And I took a similar approach for book number two as well. However, for book number two, I finally did find more men willing to talk and even more people from the LGBT community.
Yeah, that's another huge space too, where, you know, mental health advocacy is required. So it's fascinating. The couple of questions just regarding your collaborations. Since the release of your books, you have had various collaborations, at least that's what we read. You've done various collaborations to move the needle forward in the area of mental health advocacy. So can you talk to us about some of the work that you've done or you're doing since these books were released?
I'm speaking on podcasts such as this one. I've spoken on several of those. And I've also spoken on panels via Zoom. One of them, for example, was with Brown Girls Health. Shout out to them. They hired myself and they hired like therapists, and they would ask questions regarding mental health and stigma and our experiences around it. And another time I went to UW-Madison, the college in my state's capital, and they had an organization called the APIDA. It stands for Asian American Pacific Islander DACI. Mm-hmm. They hired me as for AAPI month to do a reading as well as a discussion around the book itself. And they had all their people read, all the attendees read my book. And I've done two readings and workshops for the South Asian Mental Health Consortium, which takes place once a year too.
That's amazing.
And what are your future goals? Like, where do you see this going for you, Renat?
So I published book number two in August. So right now I'm focused on, you know, getting the word out around that, since it's still relatively new. Mm-hmm. And over time, I would say that I hope to build my social media following and better figure out what it means to me to be, because as I said, I don't have a degree in psychology. I feel like that's a challenge and also a unique thing. True. In a good way at the same time, where I can speak from the personal experience perspective, as well as gather the personal experiences of that of others. So I'm on, you know, this journey of trying to figure out what that means for me as like a content creator. And I hope in the long run, I get more of, I hate to say it, but the influencer status when it comes to social media and creating this educational content around mental health in and outside of the South Asian diaspora.
So quick question, couple of questions. So you've kind of worked, you know, you kind of dabbled in the South Asian mental space and doing like amazing work with your books and your continued work in that space. So based on what you're mentioning, what are the strides we have made in the South Asian mental space from your experience? And again, what are some of the gaps you still see? You did mention the gaps you still see in some, you know, with men, you know, kind of speaking up about mental health, with, you know, LGBTQ community speaking about mental health, but just wanted to kind of tap into more of those discussions. So what are the strides we've made and what are the gaps we're seeing?
The strides we made is that we're finally talking about it. And as a result, there's more education awareness out there. Hopefully that will lead to more earlier diagnostics and therefore treatment. And I think with the treatment end, what we need to do is work towards decolonizing mental health. You know, the Western psychology system is ultimately Eurocentric. And I think that, you know, things like the DSM-5 and various diagnoses have their pros and cons at the end of the day. But some will say that they're kind of pathologizing. And I think that for South Asian people, what this could look like is getting more DACI providers working in the field. But also, you know, drawing that line between teaching these providers not to, you know, subconsciously endorse bad cultural norms when it comes to working with their clients. You know, and what I mean by that is in book number one, so many people swore that they want a Desi provider because they don't like explaining to their providers, True. You know, why their families act the way they act and whatever. Mm-hmm. However, in book number two, I learned it wasn't that simple where, you know, some people fear judgment from providers in their own community mm-hmm. or they feel like, you know, those therapists have this attitude of, oh, that's just how it is in our world, unfortunately.
Yeah, I think that's always a big issue that we have in the mental health space still, true. Because the culture and how do you approach culture, the Indian culture, the South Asian culture, and kind of, you know, admix that with mental fitness, right?
Yeah. So, and I'll say too that
good mental fitness.
And a therapist is supposed to be unbiased, true. But then, you know, some studies have shown that same race therapists may kind of over-identify with their clients in that way.
Yeah, because their story, it could be your story, and yeah. they are now trying true, story swaps are happening here yeah. versus trying to stay non-judgmental. Yeah. And I think that's where I think the biggest challenge lies in the mental health space in South Asian community is trying to understand the cultural influences that's been going on for generations. Hundreds of years ago, we've had the same cultural mindset, but times are changing. We've had a lot of globalization, you know, Western outlook is kind of seeping into the cultural landscape. And now we're at this transitional point where we are like, oh, I don't know what's right. This is what I've been taught. And this is what is, you know, this is what's happening out of the real world. Should I really uphold the cultural values that I've learned? Or should I just basically, you know, just let it all go and just let whatever influence is taking over in our culture? So I think some people, we're all like, I think we're at this transitional point, even families, even older generations, I think, started asking this question. Yeah. It used to be there back in my day like this, but I don't know if you guys are doing it different. And they're starting to see something different happening.
Yeah.
And also to your point about the elders, you know, yeah. some say that, you know, people living in India are more forward-minded than, you know, the baby boomer immigrants that are over here.
Yeah.
And that's because, you know, of how much India is changing. Mm-hmm. And when you immigrate, you don't get to witness that change. Therefore, you cling on to your old ways.
Because you're stuck. Exactly. You know, they say that whatever year you know, moved away, that's the year you're stuck in. You know, experiences kind of like stop right there. And that's how you associate, you know, whether it's your homeland or, you know, the place you grew up in. That's so true. And I think all of this is just as, I don't know, actually. That is so interesting. So I feel like all of this is just a fine line.
Yeah, in addition to the stuckness, I think what's happening is it's like, you know, you're here, it's a new country. People immigrated here. It's a new country. It's a new cultural influence around them. So it's not just only stuckness. I think they want to preserve here yeah. and make a cultural, you know, kind of spread the culture here, maintain and spread it around here. So there's a sense of comfort and security and safety that we're not completely losing the culture, even though we've moved to a whole new country. So I think it's more of that thing of not losing it in a new environment that's making people even more. And I think it's a good thing. You know, when I look back and, you know, Shweta is teaching Bharatanatyam and I see her daughter learning it, it just brings tears to my eyes because it's beautiful to see the culture being preserved. But at the same time, I think it should not be, you know, forced. It's where you draw a fine line, where you say, we do this for this reason. You know, this is a beautiful culture of thousands of years. We're trying to preserve it. But at your discretion, how much you can handle, mm-hmm. how much you can, you know, you want to keep it up. I think that's the discussion which needs to start happening
yes.
versus, oh, this is how we do. This is what you got to do. So I think that's where a lot of mental health issues. So anyway, before we come to the end, I have one important question for you. So as someone who's not a mental health professional, but a mental health advocate, with your own set of experiences and so many stories that you've heard so far, what are some of the mental well-being tools and practices we should all keep with us? I mean, probably name your top 3 to 5.
I don't think that's a universal answer because everyone's brain works different. Mm-hmm. Everyone's life experience is different. Mm-hmm. And no way of learning that better than through my book,
yeah.
where everyone will say, you know, I found therapy helpful. I didn't find therapy helpful. So I came up with my own methodologies. Mm. I find holistic helpful. I find Western medicine helpful, that kind of thing.
But do you journal, meditate? Are there certain tools that you, you know, fall back on for your own mental well-being?
For me, yes. Mm. I would say that I'm one of the few that fully endorses Western medicine and Eastern alike as far as combining them together, whereas I feel like both industries just kind of bash each other. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is I have benefited from therapy. I have benefited from psychiatric medicine. Mm-hmm. I have benefited from various holistic health practices as well, ranging from fitness and diet, including things like Ayurvedic doctors themselves, mm-hmm. Down to things like meditation and journaling, as you said.
That's really nice.
Wonderful.
Thank you so much for taking this time. And for all our listeners, if you'd like to buy Mrinal's books, Saya Unveiled and Taboo, South Asian Mental Health Stories, it's available on Amazon. Is it available in other indie bookstores or is it just Amazon? Do you want to just, leave a link for us so we can share it in the show notes?
Yes, it's available on all Amazon websites. And through me, you can get it, if you live in the U.S., of course, for a discounted for just $20 autograph.
Oh, that's so nice.
Wonderful.
Thank you so much for your time, Mrinal. And thank you for being so open and transparent to sharing your story. And I think this is exactly the kind of conversations we need to have to normalize mental health in the South Asian space.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, it was a pleasure meeting you, Mrinal.
So nice meeting you too.
Nice meeting you too. So until next time, everyone, have a lovely, lovely rest of your day. And we'll talk to you again too soon in another Tribization.
Bye.
See you folks. Bye.
Thank you so much for tuning in. We hope you enjoyed our Tribization as much as we did. Please let us know what you think. It means the world to us.
Yes, and join the Tribization on our social media channels, where we discuss the many facets of mental health and well-being and share our collective thoughts. If there's a topic you'd like us to talk about, write to us at chaibreakpodcast@gmail.com or DM us on our Instagram account.